Good morning, everyone. Welcome to each and every one of you. Our thesis during this series is up there. We believe that if we know what happens when we die, we're going to know how best to live our one and only lives. And I've tried to capture this five-week journey we've been on by kind of collecting up the four big questions of life, these deep questions, and a one-pager will appear behind me now. The deep questions of life. Number one, where did we come from? Question of origin. Number two, where are we going at the end? Question of destiny. And then having landed on those two, we then have a, if we want to be consistent, have a view with towards what is the purpose of life, what's the meaning of life, and then what is truth, what does it mean to live a moral or a just life. And just to let you know, there's whole faculties of universities looking to answer these questions, philosophy, religious studies, and each and every one of us can't outsource it to someone else. We need to answer these questions ourselves. And I thought I'd quickly map out to you how we structured the series. Week one, you'll see we kind of said, why does the afterlife matter? It's something we want to ignore. We put our heads in the ground. We don't like talking about death. It's kind of socially unacceptable. I think we do need to talk about it. Kyle then for 2 weeks spoke about heaven. Last week I spoke about judgment. And this week I'm speaking about hell. Now, we've put all this up as if Kyle and Paul have been saying all of it, just to acknowledge our sources. We're very indebted to people like Tim Keller, Randy Alcorn, Preston Sprinkle, and others. And so hopefully as we've gone along, we've referred you to it, because it's really quite impossible in a moment to capture everything. But please do come chat to us. We're open to ask questions and to point you in the right direction. But I think today, when it comes to week five, and particularly in the Atlantic seaboard, people are leaning in at this moment and saying, gee, I don't think I've heard a sermon on hell too often. Right? We don't talk about it. It's fairly rare, and it bears a little bit of comment right at the start. I think one of the reasons, quite frankly, is because it's probably the most unpopular doctrine in the West. People just do not want any idea of some kind of a judgment. And I can imagine if you're a guest here today, you're like, yeah, I was invited. My kid was in a concert. Now what happened? Like, this is really unfortunate timing. I agree. But I don't want you to switch off. I want you to consider two things right at the start. Two things before you switch off. Number one, consider the source. We're going to be looking at Jesus Christ teaching on hell. Jesus Christ, who spoke more about hell than he did on heaven. He spoke more about hell than Peter, Paul, and everyone else in the scripture together. I think if anyone else came up with this doctrine, if anyone else spoke about it, we'd look at them and go, oh, who are you to speak about this? But when we look at Jesus Christ, God with us, came to die on our behalf, a man full of wisdom, and just at a superficial historical read, probably the most massively influential religious person of all time. Just looking at the source makes you hopefully lean in and go, well, if he's talking about it, maybe I should engage with it. The second thing I would say is that a lot of us struggle with the doctrine of judgment and hell, because we kind of believe in God, but we believe that our God is more loving. Our God is more compassionate. We believe that, quite frankly, we can modify God to make him more palatable and to make him a better God than the one we kind of have inherited. But I would just push back against that and say, do you believe that your modification of a God who doesn't require justice, who doesn't require judgment, is in fact a more loving God? Because just quite frankly, what would it then cost your God to love you? What would it cost your God, your modified God, your God that kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, sees all the sins, sees all the decay in the world and says, oh, it doesn't matter. What did it cost that God to love you? I think you lose something when you put justice and love as kind of two opposite things. If you believe that justice kind of needs to get drained out of the room in order for there to be a loving God, and I believe that what we're going to hear today is a message that says, no, there is a God of justice and a God of love, and those two things come together beautifully. And we're going to have a moment of response as a community, as you can see the communion meals prepared for us at the front. So lean in, no matter where you find yourself today. It is unpopular, but I think if we look at the source of Jesus and we look at this truth that actually we need a God of justice in order for us to truly understand the love that God has for us. We're going to gain a lot together. So let's read the teaching of Jesus. He teaches in many places, but we got one long parable because he's a great teacher. He gives us a story, and we're going to be reading from Luke 16, verse 19. There was a rich man who was clothed in purple and fine linen and who feasted sumptuously every day. And at his gate was laid a poor man named Lazarus, covered with sores, who desired to be fed with what fell from the rich man's table. Moreover, even the dogs came and licked his sores. The poor man died and was carried by the angels to Abraham's side. The rich man also died and was buried. And in Hades, or hell, being in torment, he lifted up his eyes and saw Abraham far off and Lazarus at his side. And he called out, "Father Abraham, have mercy on me and send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I am in anguish in this flame." But Abraham said, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things, and Lazarus in like manner bad things. But now he is comforted here, and you are in anguish. And besides all this, between us and you, a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able, and none may cross from there to us." And he said, "Then I beg you, Father, to send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so that he may warn them, lest they also come into this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them." And he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." And he said to him, "If they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead." This is God's word to us. This is Jesus teaching on hell. But this parable is not just on hell. It actually fits into the whole pattern of Luke. You see, what Luke does quite systematically is he likes to give pairs. He likes to contrast right through. He tells stories about those who are morally and financially wealthy, those who are immoral and poor. He talks about the older brother, it's just happened now, and the younger brother who's the prodigal who ran away from the father. He's always giving these compare and contrast lessons. And again, it's the seeming outsider who ends up being in, and the seeming insider that actually is out. And I want us to lean in and think about what we can learn from the rich man and from Lazarus and compare and contrast their lives. And just so you know, we're going to be following Dr. Luke from the next couple of weeks onwards as we look at the Advent series, as we study his account of Jesus coming, Jesus being born. And so please do come and join us. We're not just looking at Luke now. We're going to continue to track his perceptive observations of what's happening. So what's our structure for today? We're going to compare and contrast, as Luke would have us do. The rich man and Lazarus, we're going to look at what it means in this life. What was the differences that they experienced in this life that we're all living in? Then we're going to look at what differences there were in the next life, and then we're going to be thinking about what that means for our life together. So from verse 19, we get introduced to the two characters, and you'll notice from verse 19, there's some obvious differences. You've got someone who is rich, and Lazarus, who is poor. You've got someone clothed in purple, fine linen, and you've got someone who doesn't, you know, have enough clothing to cover his sores so that the dogs can still get access to them. You'll see that the rich man feasts sumptuously every day, and Lazarus is kind of just grateful for the leftovers. You know, the doggy bag would literally be what he would want in this life. You keep reading, and you'll notice that the rich man died and was buried. He obviously had some kind of a formal burial. We don't see anything equivalent for Lazarus. He probably was just chucked in a grave somewhere, chucked in a hole. You know, that was the end of his life. And so it comes as a little bit of a surprise that the one who makes it into heaven is Lazarus. Surely the wealthy guy was favored by God. I mean, he had so much good in this life. Why would he be separated from God in the next life? It's easy to think if you're financially wealthy, you must have some spiritual wealth as well. There's some blessing bank that you've been able to fill up. It's very easy to slip into spiritual pride. It's not a long jump if we've been successful in this life to think that's going to translate into something into the future. But that's not to say, okay, I get it, Paul. God's into the outsider being in. So obviously, if you have a good life on this life, you kind of get punished in the future life. Is that how it works? You know, you were the rich are kind of bad. Is that what you're saying, Paul? They go to hell, and then the underdogs in this life, they go to heaven. Is that the teaching? And the answer is no. No, there's nothing to indicate that. That's not the reason that we would separate the two. What we've actually missed in our analysis and comparison so far is actually what is the biggest difference between them. The biggest difference. Can you see the biggest difference? The difference is that one of them has a name. Lazarus. It's the only parable that Jesus ever tells where there is a name. Jesus speaks about sowers and shepherds and farmers and sheep, But nowhere else is anyone ever given a name. This is the only parable where someone has a name, Lazarus. So why is one in heaven and one in hell? The answer doesn't lie in their behaviors. The answer lies in their names. Lazarus has a name. Now, the rich man also has a name, but notice the name is about what he pursued in this life. He pursued wealth. He thought being rich was what it was all about. He got purple. He got fine linen. He feasted. He placed that at the center. And you can see in verse 25, it says, Abraham said to him, "Child, remember that you in your lifetime received your good things. You pursued those things and you received them. You did become rich. That became your identity. But notice now, when it comes to the next life, you don't have a name left. You gave yourself to riches, but those don't continue with you into the next life." Can you see this happening? Can you see this happening even in your own heart? Those things that we latch onto and place at the center, those things that want to name us and define us, those things we can easily get addicted to, well, when they fall apart, when they don't join us in the next life, we don't just lose things, we lose our very selves. We fall apart. When you lose your name, which you've put at the center, you fall to pieces. Lazarus, however, had a name. And the name Lazarus means the Lord is my help. The Lord is my help. He had a hard time in this life, no doubt. He was poor. He wasn't well fed. The dogs came and licked his sores. But at the center, at the comfort, what he'd settled inside of himself was that his identity was not any of those things. His identity was that the Lord was his help. And so these two men had built their lives on two completely different bases. One had a name that would last forever. The Lord is his help. The other one had a name that was only good for this life. Now, I want to press us here because it's really key that we get this to understand Jesus' teaching on hell. Jesus is saying, if you look to anything else other than God to be your help, to be your firm foundation, that thing will define you, it'll overtake you, and ultimately it will collapse you for eternity. At this time of the year, we like to do Christmas-themed family movies on Friday night for Sabbath, you know, Shabbat Shalom in Sea Point, as you'd say. And what movie we watched this week was The Christmas Carol. Well, it's Dickens' book, Christmas Carol, but the version we watched was old Scrooge, animated version. And if you've watched this, you've essentially seen someone who could quite easily draw a line to the rich man, someone who had defined his life by wealth. And as people try to reach out and had to crack his kind of harsh exterior, he would kind of go, "Ah, I don't need people. I don't need others. You know, this is all humbug. This is all nonsense." And he gets visited by different ghosts over time, and slowly but surely starts to see what poverty actually sits at the center of his life now that he's placed his whole wealth and his considerable riches at the center of who he was. What's actually happened as he's done that is he's been robbed of everything, robbed of relationships, robbed of all that matters. There's nothing left, ultimately, and that's why the ghosts come visit him. C.S. Lewis puts it as follows. He says, "Hell begins with a grumbling mood, always complaining, always blaming others, but you're still distinct from it. You may even criticize it in yourself and wish you could stop it, but there may come a day when you can no longer. Then there will be no you left to criticize the mood or even to enjoy it, but just the grumble itself, going on forever like a machine. It is not a question of God sending us to hell. In each of us there is something growing which will be hell unless it is nipped in the bud." What C.S. Lewis is basically saying, his kind of thesis, and you can believe in it or not, is that he says, you know, you'll start out as the Paul who grumbles. You'll kind of be Paul who grumbles. "Oh, it's not quite working out the way I hoped." And then keep that up and you'll become Paul the grumbler. Enough people will be like, "Oh, that guy, yeah, I know him. He's grumbly." Until finally, you're just a grumble that goes on forever. There's no you left. You've just been overtaken by the thing that you hoped would satisfy you and it never did. It's a little bit like a briar. Once you've burnt the coals and you come to it and it's all the ash, you know, you can blow and try and find something there. And maybe there is, and you can kind of reignite things. But sometimes you can blow and there's actually nothing left. It's just a grumble. The you that God created has been marred by that which you placed at the center. I think if you're honest, you've seen this in action, right? You've seen this in your own heart and the lives of others. You don't have to wait till you die to kind of look at what hell looks like. Anyone who's trapped in an addiction, anyone who's had these insatiable desires that have really gutted them from the inside out. You've seen this dynamic at heart. You get caught up in bitterness, and professionals will look at the symptoms of ulcers and stress and all those things. There's a physical breakdown because this is a reality. Jeff Cook, just to really summarize this point, says, the more I make my life, my well-being, my enlightenment, and my success primary, the further I step from reality. Thus, the hellbound do not travel downward, they travel inward, cocooning themselves behind a mass of vanities, personal rights, religiosity, and defensiveness. Obsession with self is the defining mark of a disintegrating soul. Paul, not me, another Paul who wrote most of the New Testament, said, in the end times, it's going to be terrible. In these last days, it's going to be terrible. Why? Because people are going to be lovers of themselves. Bernard, writing a little bit after that, spoke about how self-love can be incredibly damaging. He says it can burst the banks of self-control, flooding the field with self-indulgence. I can feel this in my own heart. I'm an Enneagram 3 achiever type. I like getting things done. If I'm winning and achieving, life is good. If I'm not, life is not good. I go all quiet and I try to solve the problem. Is that sinful? Is that not just the way God made me? Yeah, I don't think it has to be sinful. But when I notice in my heart the fluctuations becoming more and more extreme, I suddenly realize, wait a second, have I replaced God and put my achievement at the center? If I'm looking down on others and go, oh, these people are just not making it as much as I am. If I lack empathy, like, where's your hustle, people? Suddenly I'm starting to get a trigger for the grumble that could go on for all eternity. If achievement becomes my help and becomes my center, then I'm ceasing to be the person God created me to be. Lazarus, however, if we look at him, had a name. He'd placed the Lord as his help. And so when he passed through death, when he passed into the next life, his name continued. Every other name will break except that name of the Lord. And so as we conclude this first point, do you have a name? Do you have a name? Are you the Lord's, or are you first and foremost a professional, first and foremost a mother, first and foremost someone who's got a great spouse? What is it that you use to name yourself? What is it that you place at the center? Anything else than God will literally be hell. Let's compare and contrast the rich man Lazarus in the next life. In the next life, we're going to learn a lot about what the next life looks like from this parable. You'll see that first and foremost, hell is a place of disintegration, this next life that the rich man finds himself. You'll see he says, Father Abraham, have mercy on me. Send Lazarus to dip the end of his finger in water and cool my tongue, for I'm anguish in flame. We know what a fire does, right? It disintegrates. There's something that was whole, that had its bonds, it was you know, cohesive, and a flame comes in and it breaks those bonds apart. It disintegrates. The thing's still there, but it's just not what it was made to be. It's been broken down. This is exactly what sin does, right? God is described as the one in whom all things consist. He holds the whole universe together. Even those that believe in him or don't, God and God alone is the one that holds us together. He's the only source of coherence. But as we move away from him, as we replace him, we break down. The absence of God is a raging fire, spiritually speaking. And Tim Keller, at this point, he pastored in New York for many years. People would ask him, Tim, do you believe in literal fire? Do you actually believe in this? Like, is this what hell's going to be like? And he would say, no, you can't take it literally. This is figurative language. And they go, oh, I'm so relieved to hear that. He said, no. Fire actually represents something far worse. Far worse. Because to be apart from God is to be devastating. Devastated entirely. You see, it's not to be taken lightly, this teaching that we are spiritually in a raging fire if we have the absence of God. So it is a place of disintegration, breaking apart. Next thing it is it's a place of separation. If we read on, Abraham answers him and he says in verse 26, besides all this, between us and you a great chasm has been fixed in order that those who would pass from here to you may not be able and none may cross from there to us. It's a teaching there that there's a great chasm. It's been fixed, a great gulf, a separation between you and the presence of God. And you can see this at play in the rich man. You notice, interestingly, he never begs for forgiveness. He doesn't even speak to God. He speaks to Abraham. He's like not even interested in God. He's saying to Abraham, hey, man, I don't want forgiveness and I don't even want escape. I just want a little bit of comfort while I'm down here. There's a caricature which Jesus wants to break down. It's a caricature that hell is sort of some kind of dungeon and there are all these people desperately trying to get out and then God's on the top and there's like a little manhole cover and he's just slamming it down all the time going, ha, ah, no such luck. Caricatures, you know, appalling on two levels. One, it's appalling because it assumes people are trying to get out. That's not what we see here. And secondly, it appears that God is somehow enjoying this. That's certainly not the case. You see, what's happening in the life of Lazarus, and we can feel this even in our own hearts at times, is that something inside of us, a sin which we can often turn to, is basically a message to God saying, God, leave me alone. Just leave me alone. I just want to do this on my own. The Pharisees, by the way, who the chief audience Jesus is telling this parable to, they told God to leave them alone by doing a whole bunch of good deeds. They were like, look, God, you can't be on our case. We've done all this good stuff. This is religion, religiosity. You've got to leave us alone because we're on your team. But essentially, it was the same message that all of us give, which is like, God, leave me alone. Everyone's saying it. And hell is kind of God saying, okay, you've been trying to get away from me your whole life. Go for it. Parents, I think we know a little bit about this. Hey guys, the stove's hot. Don't touch the stove. Never touch the stove. The heater's hot. Don't get changed close to the heater. This is a true life story. No, we want to get changed close to the heater. Okay, cool. Good luck. And as Benny now to put the pants on, the bare buttock touched the grid. And there's still a tattoo mark. If you ask me, does my kid have a tattoo? One of my kids has a tattoo. But at some point, you just go, well, look, I keep talking. But at some point, instead of my will be done, it's your will be done and their consequences. What would you have God do to a whole bunch of people saying, God, leave me alone, leave me alone? Well, I think you'd probably say, well, can't God save them? Well, that's exactly what he did. He sent his son, Jesus Christ, to represent us. He sent his son to die on Calvary. He sent his son. He's freely offered by grace and mercy to each and every person. He's done that. He's made a way. All needs is people to say, I want to turn to you. That's all that's required. God's already done that. They just don't want anything to do with God. They think God's a fiction. They think, oh, God's for the people that need him, people that have a bit of a hard life, or people like Lazarus. You know, you need a crutch. I don't need any help from God. This whole God thing's like a bunch of humbug, is what kind of Scrooge would say. It's like, it's for the losers, not for me. One of the scariest verses in Romans 1, where it says, therefore God gave them up in their lusts. It's the parent eventually said, okay, you don't want my will done. It'll be your will done. Hell is God saying in the deepest recesses, okay. And that separation lasts for eternity. God is the source of all good things, but we want to jump away from him. And we believe, then I will be free. If I just get away from God, then I'll be free. You'll be independent, but you won't be free. You'll be overtaken by the fire of what you've chosen for eternity. And I know you're sitting there going, but Paul, these consequences seem a little bit over the top. I mean, how does this play out? Maybe it's helpful to think about it this way. If someone arrived at the back and kind of had a go at me and said, you're an idiot, you're a useless preacher, and left, I'd go, I don't know them. I mean, it's slightly painful, awkward, but I'm moving on with my life. If my wife, however, said similar words, someone more intimate, someone who knows me more, the impact would be much more devastating, much bigger. Well, if you turn around to an eternal God who created you and made you for intimacy with him, and you want out and you walk away, the consequences are much more devastating than if it was someone on the periphery of your life. And there's a quick sidebar here, and to say that, you know, across theological camps, people agree on hell. They say there's a hell, but what they disagree on are two things. One is the duration, as well as the reversibility. And so comment on the duration. Some look at the scriptures and say, no, it's eternal conscious torment. This is you grumbling on for all eternity apart from God. You're not looking for forgiveness. You're not looking to be reconciled. You, as we'll see soon, are incredibly self-deceived and you're going to continue in that path. Others would say, no, if you separate from God, you're separating from life. You're separating from goodness. Then how can you live apart from God? There's no life. There's nothing to keep you together. And so the duration then is kind of much shorter, and there's a camp known as the annihilationists. And as you look at it, you can find good scriptures and arguments for both on those camps. And so when it comes to duration, we'd say, yeah, there's two schools of thought, eternal conscious torment as well as annihilationism. And you can look at Preston Sprinkle and Francis Chan, who brought out a book on erasing God, which is very good on drawing those out. But what I would say is that there's a camp which we don't see biblical warrant for, which is a camp that sort of says, no, yes, there's going to be a judgment. Yes, there's going to be people that are going to be, you know, separate from God, but, you know, love wins would kind of be the message. And we believe it's reversible, that somehow there's going to be this reversion back to God. And I would say I don't find biblical merit for that, that is not a belief we see. To suddenly see a God who gives us free will, gives us choice, suddenly overriding at the end might just be more of our cultural longing for something than I would agree is biblical. And we can chat more about that, but I just did want to take a little sideline there. We keep reading about Lazarus and the rich man, and you'll notice at this point the rich man now gets seemingly empathetic. He's kind of going, okay, wait, I'm not going to get my tongue cooled. Fine. Here's my next request. I beg you, Father, verse 27, send Lazarus, like he's kind of my slave guy, to my father's house, for I have five brothers, so he may warn them lest they also come into this place of torment. What's the third thing we learn about hell? It is a place of disintegration. It's a place of separation. Now we learn it's a place of just self-deception. Self-deception. Notice that this rich man is still ordering Lazarus around. He's in the next life, but he's still caught in this world where he's used to getting what he wants. And he's saying, come, send him down to wipe my brow. Okay, he won't do that. Okay, send him out to my brothers to sort them out. And it seems like super empathetic, like, wow, he's finally caring about others. But have you really picked up what's happening? He's accusing Abraham. He's kind of going, hey, man, I wasn't given enough info. Please help my brothers. They need more info. I didn't get enough, you know? He's got no idea really where he is or why he's there. He's not asking for forgiveness. He wants comfort. And the lack of self-knowledge is incredibly total in hell. He is not asking to be let out. And the only reason he's concerned about his brothers is because he feels like he got a raw shake in this life. Have you seen this in your own life? I think of guests visiting here, even in our own hearts, we can often just think, oh, God and these people and all that's going on about religion. And there's just this grumbling spirit when it comes to this. Life isn't fair. This whole thing isn't fair. And yet I would say today, Jesus' teaching to us is that it's entirely fair. Hell is a place of disintegration, separation, and self-deception. It's a place where there is punishment, banishment, and destruction. And it's a place of justice. And Jesus is trying to clear up the characters in our mind that might have been in there until now. And what Jesus is quite clearly teaching is that hell is not something for one day then, but it can start on this side of eternity already and go on forever. And so in closing, let's think about what this would mean for our own lives. What it would mean for our own lives. You'll see in verse 30, he says, no, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent. But Abraham says to him, if they do not hear Moses and the prophets, neither will they be convinced if someone should rise from the dead. The rich man at this point is saying, I had Moses and the prophet, but they weren't enough. Why don't you send Lazarus to my brothers? And he'll be someone who's come back from the dead. I mean, that will surely get their attention. And you'll notice what he's told. Nah, that won't. They'll kind of go, oh, it was an hallucination, or Lazarus never really died. It was some kind of hoax. And they'll move on with their lives. They won't want to give up what's at the center. You see, there is an antidote to hell, but many will not take it. The rich man wants someone to come back from the dead. Isn't that exactly what Jesus Christ has done? He literally came back from the dead. And he extends his invitation to all of us. And Abraham's pretty convinced. He says, hey, they've got the prophets. Why don't they just read the prophets? Let's just read, before going to the communion meal, from one of the prophets, Isaiah. This is Isaiah chapter 53, written years before Christ would come, from verse 10. He says, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, out of the anguish of his soul he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. We'll leave that up for a while. If you've arrived here today saying, I can't believe in a God of hell. I can't believe in a God of justice. My God would be more loving. My God would be more compassionate than that. A simple question to you would be, well, what did it cost you, your God? Sorry, what would it cost your God to love you? How do you know he loves you? If he just kind of goes nudge, nudge, wink, wink to everyone, what does his love really mean? I think you'd have to answer nothing. It cost him nothing. He just loves everyone. But again, to the parents or anyone who's really loved out there, you know if you truly love someone, it involves suffering. It involves sacrifice. It involves laying your life down. And there's only one God who's suffered in order to love us. There's only one God who poured his wrath out on Jesus Christ so that we could experience this God of love. Verse 10 says, it was the will of God to crush him. I said earlier, if someone far away criticizes you, that's easy to do. But if it's someone close, it's devastating. The Father and the Son, for all eternity, had been in an intimate relationship of love with one another. And yet Jesus Christ on the cross experienced for the first time separation from the Father. Such pain to be separated from one you'd been eternally connected towards. He knew it was happening. His soul was in anguish. He was sweating blood as he approached what he knew would happen, and yet he did it. And yet it says, having paid that considerable price, drinking the cup of wrath to the bottom, it says that he was satisfied. You saw it there. He shall see and be satisfied. What was he satisfied with? He was satisfied with the rescuing work that would include you and I in his kingdom forever. See, if you believe in a God of justice, you can also believe in a God of love who took that justice upon himself to rescue those who don't deserve it. Receive his mercy and grace and hear him say these words, I paid for it in full and it was worth it. You were worth it. If you want an identity that goes beyond riches or the way that you attract other people or your accomplishments, if you want an identity that lasts forever, you need to know whose you are and you need to know that that person loves you. With all your nonsense, with all your rebellion, he loves you. And how do you know he loves you? He loves you because he went to the cross to pay the price for you. If we lose the depths of hell, we lose the love of God. In closing, Martin Lloyd-Jones gave the following analogy. He said, if you received a letter, but like none of us receive letters, imagine your friend comes and says, hey, there was a mix-up. I got emailed a bill that you owed. But don't worry, I paid for it. At that point, you'd be like, well, what was the bill? Because that would affect your reaction, right? If the bill was like your SABC TV license, it's the right thing to do. You'd be like, thanks, but I wasn't really paying. No, sorry, you shouldn't say that. If it was your school fees, you'd be like, thank you, good heavens, expensive on the Atlantic seaboard, I appreciate you. If it was your bond, you'd be like, friend, I'm so grateful for you in my life. But what if it was your rebellion and your selfishness, your curved inness on yourself for all eternity? What if that was what God paid? And what if he invites you today to accept that payment at the communion table? Jesus literally did come back from the dead to tell us about God's love. Will you accept his invitation? And as we wrap up this afterlife series, there really are two trajectories to this life. A trajectory which places God at the center and grows in Christ-like more and more. A trajectory that places some other thing at the center which moves further and further, further towards disintegration, grumbling, and separation. The choice is ours. Have you got your good things in this life? Do you have a name in this life that won't pass to the next, or do you have God as your help? You need to know who you are. You need to know whose you are. You need to know you're valuable. You need to know you're loved. And you need to know where you're going. That's what gives you a self. That's what gives you an identity that'll last for eternity.